Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to the Total Soccer Show's weekend review. The final bot between Pep and Klopp was far from a flop in front of the Kop as City and Liverpool ensured the action didn't stop. But neither team finished the weekend on top as the Gunners became the cream of the crop. Elsewhere, Harry Kane brought the pain as Bayern made gains against Mainz, and Mbappe was unhappy while PSG played tippy-tappy. My name's Ryan Bailey. Joining me today, your friend and mine, Taylor Rockwell. Hello, Taylor.
Hello, that was a bop right off the top. I'm trying to continue the rhyming scheme.
There's only so many of the words that rhyme with that, so I had to stop at that point, Taylor.
I think you got them all. I think I may have reused top. That was excellent, Ryan Bailey. Well done.
Oh, so kind. Joining us also, a Scot with greater longevity than Neil Warnock in Aberdeen, it's Graham Ruthven. Hello, Graham.
Hello, Ryan Bailey. Yes, that is a low bar. 33 days for Mr. Warnock.
He's already gone? Aberdeen.
He is already gone, yes. Yes, he left after Saturday's match.
Wait,
it was
so
quite
Neil Warnock,
a wild ride.
Neil Warnock, who we, I believe, messaged about not long ago to say, like, oh, he's taking over Aberdeen, is already gone. So what went wrong, Graham? Aside from it being Aberdeen.
Lost a lot of matches, seemed to hate Aberdeen as much as Christian Ramirez did. So,
In the Soccer Dispatch, available in all email inboxes, there is a video link of Neil Warnock doing the press conference where he's saying, he's at the press conference at Aberdeen, he's saying, like, my wife said, Aberdeen, are you sure? And he's in like a room full of Aberdeen people, and they're like,
perfect.
He clearly just didn't fancy it. Scottish football isn't for everyone. You and Neil Warnock, Ryan, you're in good company.
Yeah, it's good. Yeah, fair enough. I probably have the same reaction in that press conference.
What is the city that, Graham, you think, if you heard of a continental coach going there, you would be like, that's not going to go well for them? Is there a city in Scotland that you personally don't feel like hanging out in?
Dundee has a bit of a reputation. It's had a bit of investment on the waterfront, but further back from the waterfront, wouldn't walk through those streets. I feel a bit like Ryan Bailey turning my nose up at the north in Dundee.
There, I heard, as well. Yeah,
and crocodiles,
indeed. Patreon.com.
That means, but okay.
Crocodile Dundee.
I hate myself. It's early, sort of, kind of, not really.
Anyway, patreon.com/totalsoccershow. For all our bonus content, we've got bonus episodes, bonus videos, access to our Discord where all the cool kids hanging out. Most recently, or certainly over the weekend on the Discord, Taylor Rockwell's mesmerizing cooking class.
It's hypnotic, right? It's really hypnotic.
It's all in the edit, I think. It was hypnotic, Taylor, watching you make some cheeky nuggies. Very nice.
That was my actual speed. I don't know what you all are talking about. That's how fast I move. I did mean to like mute it or set it to music or something, but as a result of not doing that, you can hear my daughter speaking to me in the very beginning, sped up 8 times, which makes it sound like I'm being yelled at by like a tiny chipmunk. It's pretty adorable. It made me happy. I'm still very annoyed with myself for not getting Crocodile Dundee. I feel like I've already kind of failed this performance. It's 5 minutes into the game, and I've scuffed a shot wide, and I'm not sure there's any coming back from it.
Well, let's see if you can recover, Taylor, in our
probably
opening
not
segment here. We're talking Premier League, biggest game of the season. Liverpool 1, Manchester City 1. Great quality game, I would say. Certainly lived up to its billing. We had John Stones with the opener cancelled out by Alexis McAllister from the spot after Edison's robust challenge on Nunes to get that penalty. Controversial penalty call at the death in this one as well. Taylor, this was a good game of the Sockers.
It very much was, especially in the second half. If you are a Liverpool supporter, the way they came out, the way they really went at City, they kind of played, as cliche as it may sound, without fear. They didn't seem overwhelmed by the occasion. They didn't seem overwhelmed by being 1-0 down. And I thought we're the better team in the second half. But in the first half, I have to spotlight that goal for City. It is master set piece theater. It's one of our favorite things. It is an amazing goal. I did not know that they were also capable of scoring incredibly well-designed set pieces.
It's over for us all. If City are scoring those sort of goals, then we might as well, we might as well give up.
And it's a great, like, well-designed set piece to begin with. It is clearly one where they watched a bunch of footage of Liverpool defending set pieces and spotted there is an opportunity here if Kevin De Bruyne pings a low ball along the end line, and then if Nathan Ake clears out whomever is marking him, in this case I believe it was Alexis McAllister, it opens up space for someone to run into. That someone in this case would be John Stones, who turns it in at the near post. 1-0 and a excellent goal, which I didn't think would be the way City would take the lead given some of the opportunities they had. But I guess when Liverpool have Virgil van Dijk defending, it limits the effectiveness of some of those scoring opportunities.
Yeah, talking about Virgil van Dijk, Graham, one of the things that the analysts picked up, and certainly on the NBC feed, was that duel he had with Erling Haaland, where he was sort of tracking him, turning over his shoulder each way. They sort of, like, to the layman, Virgil van Dijk was just running along next to him, but it was very well done indeed to keep Haaland from having a particularly dangerous shot.
That was my favourite moment of the whole match, was Haaland running full speed at van Dijk. All the talk of tactics and technical ability, and actually in that moment I realised all I want in football is two men, mountains, charging at each other. If IFAB could manufacture at least one of those moments per game, or maybe we could start like removing players every 10 minutes until we just have van Dijk and Haaland charging at each other. I would forgive all the VAR stuff. That is all I want from football. It was very entertaining.
It really was. It's one of those things where you can watch it over and over and just spot a little wrinkle, a new little thing. Because, again, to Ryan's point, at first it just looks like at one point Virgil van Dijk is running the wrong way and looking behind him and trying to see where Erling Haaland is. And he is, that is true, but the way he's doing it, the way he doesn't sort of overcommit in one direction, he's clearly trying to push Erling Haaland wide to his left and then put pressure on him when the shot actually occurs, and that's exactly what happens. But so often we see a defender try to square up in that scenario and be beaten at speed. We see a defender sort of try to show an attacker one way and get beaten the other. And the way Virgil van Dijk really just makes Haaland make the first move and then shuts him down from there, Haaland ends up getting the shot off. But it's a fairly tame effort with his left instep from sort of a wider angle right at the goalkeeper. I really do. Graham, I'm right there with you. Put it in the veins. Watch it over and over again because it is an excellent example of world-class defending.
Yeah, I certainly agree that Van Dijk did as well as anyone really can in that situation, but I think it does underline just how good Erling Haaland is, that while Van Dijk did everything perfectly, it's not a great look at goal, but Haaland still gets like a shot on target from that situation. So it's not very encouraging for the rest of the Premier League central defenders that's what it takes to stop Erling Haaland, and then even in that instance, he gets a shot on goal.
And Haaland has, I guess, for him, a quiet game, though he doesn't score any sitters from 4 yards out, so I guess that's progress. But I still thought he was really, really fun to watch in this game for moments like what we've just talked about. But also, his ability to play on the turn is something that maybe he's always had, but that feels like something that has improved under Pep Guardiola, where he oftentimes turns with one touch and then plays a really smart through ball with his second, and has become such a pivotal link-up player in how they want to attack, but then also such a pivotal player in just outright attacking. Those little wrinkles being added to his game, I think, are reasons why we've seen him become this elite player more so than he already was. And again, I think credit to Pep for working with him to make some of that happen.
Yeah, I thought he was very effective in the first half, Taylor, in those moments that you're spotlighting there. And I thought City in general, we'll come on to Liverpool because I think they're probably the team that maybe deserve a little bit more credit when we're talking about the bigger picture here.
Okay.
But in the first half, I thought City were really strong, and they were squeezing the space in their own half whenever Liverpool had it, and then opening up the space on the attack. And I thought they looked really dangerous in transition, and that's where those Haaland on the turn moments would come in. But there was good fluidity between Foden and Alvarez and De Bruyne, and a good few times in the first half it felt like City were just one perfect pass away from being clean through with 3-on-3 attacks and Haaland drawing defenders. And there was one moment when Bernardo Silva was just maybe a slightly better touch away from being clean through into the box. And on the other side of the game, on the defensive side for City, Liverpool were being forced to go long to avoid the Man City press. And what that was doing was it was meaning the ball was just coming straight back at them far too quickly as far as they were concerned. And I felt like for the opening 30 minutes, certainly it was City that were on top. when stupid sexy John Stones scores that set piece routine, at that point I'm thinking this has the feeling of a Man City routine, maybe like 2-0 win, which is rare for them at Anfield. But the second half was a completely different story and Liverpool came back into it.
Yeah. If your favourite moment, Graham, was the Haaland v Virgil van Dijk duel, mine was the Phil Foden effort, which he knew nothing about, that hit the crossbar that came off the goalkeeper. That was a very amusing moment for me, just because both looked baffled about what had just happened previously. But perhaps, Graham, we should talk about Liverpool, as you say. Jurgen Klopp calling this a brave performance. Certainly true to say they're the better of the second half. Do you think they'll regret not closing this one out with a win?
Yeah, I think if you'd said to them before the game that this one would end 1-1, they might have taken that, given obviously the players that are out injured for them at the moment. Mohamed Salah doesn't start this game. I was sure that he was going to. He featured in the Europa League against Sparta Prague during the week, and so I was certain he was going to start this one. He didn't. So clearly his injury is a little bit more severe than Klopp and Liverpool have let on. So if you'd offered them a 1-1 draw before the game, they would have taken it. But the way that this second half in particular panned out, it felt like an opportunity for Liverpool to take 3 points from this one. I thought the way that City deteriorated in the second half, so Pep makes a couple changes with 20 minutes left, because City needed them at that point. Their level had dropped off in the second half, and we can talk about whether that was things that Liverpool were doing or whether that was on City that their level had dropped. But there was a reaction from Kevin De Bruyne when he's hooked by Pep Guardiola. I thought at that point he'd fallen out of the game. I thought Pep Guardiola was justified to take him off. They were struggling to get the ball to him, and when they did, De Bruyne was losing his duel, or he was taking a poor first touch. The other player who came off was Julian Alvarez. Now, I'm a big Julian Alvarez fan. I highlighted him a number of times at the start of the season, but I've also highlighted some of his shortcomings in the past few weeks, and I don't think he had a great game here either. He gave away the ball too often, a lot of the time in dangerous situations, which led to Liverpool attacks. It seemed like Pep wanted Alvarez to stay away from the middle, where he's been playing out of possession these last few games, but it didn't really feel like he was having much of an influence out in the wide area. And an even bigger issue for City was that increasingly Liverpool were able to activate that front three of Diaz, Nunes and Salah when he came on off the bench in the second half against the City back three. So there was at least two occasions where it was a 3-on-3 situation for Liverpool. And this is where I give them praise for kind of figuring that out. I thought Van Dijk's diagonal balls into Mohamed Salah was a key way that they were able to get forward in the second half once he comes on. But it was mixed fortunes for Liverpool's, because Luis Diaz, he's a little bit difficult to address, because I thought there was a lot of good from him, and he's a handful with his movement and his direct running, but also he's quite ragged in some of his finishing and decision-making here. Salah came on in the second half, and having him on the right, as I say, gave Liverpool that direct outlet. But also he looked a bit rusty. There was a couple of times when he didn't hold his run as you would expect against the City high line. And then Darwin Nunes as well, who was very Darwin Nunes in this game, won a penalty, but also couldn't hold his run, a little bit ragged in his decision making. So had the three of those players been just a little bit more refined, I think Liverpool probably would have won this game.
I agree, because I think Liverpool really come out in that second half like fired up, ready to go. And I think the penalty is obviously so critical in the way the second half plays out. Not breaking any new ground by saying that conceding a penalty in the first minute of the second half and then conceding that penalty probably is not what you want to do if you are Man City. But for Liverpool, it has to be a sort of motivator. And I do feel like that was the thing that really like leveled them up and kept them going in that second half, to press high and to have it immediately result in a penalty and a yellow card and an injury for the goalkeeper all at once. It's a sort of careless back pass from McKay. It's under hit.
Hospital pass, you might say. Literally a hospital pass.
It really was. Well said. Well said. That is the origin of that term, because it puts you into a situation where then you're going to have contact and you might be in the hospital, and I think Ederson was. And it's an excellent penalty as well. So well taken by McAllister. Very calm. He looked very nervous. The commentators were saying he looks completely undeterred by everything that's happening. He looked pretty nervous to me, but he buried that thing. And from there on, it felt like Liverpool really were the team that were controlling things a bit more. City still have their opportunities, don't get me wrong, but it just felt like Liverpool's game plan was working more effectively, such that City have to make the changes that Graham already mentioned.
Graham, this one billed as the final Pep versus Klopp, the presumption being that neither of them are going to take jobs ever again after this, I suppose, but maybe the final duel between them with these teams, of course. Disappointed that Peter Drury didn't do more Greek god comparisons at the end of the game, but there we are. But do we regard this as a sort of peak Klopp versus Pep, this kind of performance here, and immovable object versus unstoppable force, etc.?
I'm not sure if I would consider this one of the peak matches of their rivalry. That's not to say this wasn't an entertaining match, but I think when you have Salah on the bench and Liverpool missing a number of their key players, I would really consider was it two seasons ago where Liverpool and City just won like every match to finish the season, and there was like a point between them in the Premier League title race, and that was when you had the Liverpool front through Firmino and Salah and Mane, and then you know, obviously City were very strong. So that was kind of the peak matches were around that time. I also think of some of the Champions League matches. I remember Liverpool beating Man City 3-0 in the Champions League, which is when I really realised that Liverpool were close to Manchester City's level and could give them a bloody nose. But yeah, it is a shame that this is the final Premier League meeting between Pep and Klopp. I think these matches replaced... I was thinking about this earlier on. I think they replaced Barcelona-Real Madrid matches in terms of being the most... How would I word this? You sit down and you watch these matches and you can't take your eyes off them, and you just get the weight of importance, and you're very aware of you're watching the best that European football has to offer at this moment. I think that's really the place that these matches occupied in the Premier League for the last like 5 years. So it is a shame that that is sort of over now. But this was a decent finale between these two rivals.
Yeah, I think I agree with Graham largely. I would say that in this one, we have Liverpool who have... truly an absurd number of injuries, and especially two key players. And yet that you see the Liverpool style and the Liverpool philosophy under Klopp on display, that even with deputies and younger players, they still go out, press, work as a unit, hunt in packs, win the ball, get into challenges, frustrate the opposition. It did feel like a definitive Klopp performance. And with the injuries and the lack of depth they have, it also felt like a reminder of what he has been able to build, that in that identity, in that philosophy, if somebody gets hurt, somebody else can come in and more or less do the same thing, or is expected at the very least to do the same thing. You don't have to have wholesale changes to your style of play because one or two or three players are missing. And by contrast with Man City, you have so many strong, talented players in there that it did feel like a philosophy versus a philosophy and an identity in Manchester City, because you've got a lot of individuals in there. So I think in that way, I found this one really captivating because it was such a threadbare Liverpool team causing problems against a very strong Manchester City.
Well, there we go. A battle of the Titans here. Liverpool in second with 64 points. Man City in third with 63, a point between them. Arsenal on top, so it'll be amusing if Arsenal go and win the league ahead of both of these teams, given the gargantuan nature of this performance and this rivalry. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk about Arsenal's game and much, much more. Back shortly.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Today's episode is brought to you by Shopify. On the Total Soccer Show, we often talk about the importance of a manager who can clearly and effectively communicate their tactics and then a squad of players capable of executing that approach, but also adding some individual flair along the way. And that's the same relationship you're getting with Shopify. You tell them how you want things to work or what you need to get done, and they execute the game plan, sometimes even better than you could have expected, with Shopify Magic, their AI-powered all-star. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage to the first real store stage, all the way to the did we just hit over a million orders stage? Shopify is there to help you grow. From what I've heard from family members who use Shopify for their online store, which has evolved into an amazing brick-and-mortar location, Shopify has helped with that growth, and with every step along the way, they've made it easier to process and track orders, run the business day-to-day, and help with long-term growth as well. So whether you're auctioning autographed jerseys or selling custom stadium prints, both of which are awesome, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% compared to other leading commerce platforms. And you can sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, the aforementioned AI-powered all-star. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the United States and is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. countries. Plus, their extensive help resources are there to support your success every step of the way, because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial at shopify.com/TSS. That's all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/TSS now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. One more time, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/TSS.
Total Soccer Show, we are reviewing the weekend, which brings us to Arsenal's 2-1 win over Brentford, which put Arsenal top of the Premier League on Saturday, the first time they've been top since December. Declan Rice and Kai Havertz getting the goals there, and getting Aaron Ramsdale, Graham, out of jail for the error that led to the Brentford.
Yeah, first of all, a word for narrative master Aaron Ramsdale in the Arsenal team for this match, because David Raya can't play against his parent club. Yes, that's right. David Raya is still on loan from Brentford at this point. And as soon as you see the team sheet with Ramsdale in there, you just knew that two things would happen. One, that he would make a mistake, and boy, did he oblige there. And two, Arsenal would win and he would noise up the away fans, and he obliged there as well. A knee slide and everything, cupping his ears to the Brentford supporters. Sensational scenes. I can't decide if I love him or hate him, but he is he's good value, isn't he, Aaron Ramsdale?
We love him. Former AFC Wimbledon player Aaron Ramsdale, we love him on the soccer show. Just see,
that's where he learned the dark arts, was Wimbledon. There's like a class with Vinnie Jones that you get in the youth academy.
Can we talk about the howler, such as it was, for a moment? Because it is a howler. It is a humiliating, embarrassing thing for people who haven't seen it. He takes a touch, then he takes about 400 little steps before trying to kick the ball. The kick is blocked by Visa, and it goes into the goal. And I watched it so many times trying to figure out what he does wrong. And I think my conclusion is that it's a lot of little things that add up to a major mistake, because I don't think the first touch is particularly bad. I don't think he's like messing around, and because at first I assumed he just took way too long, and he doesn't really. But I think it is just that his footing is strange. I think he's not quite sure what he wants to do right away. And because of the pressure from Wissa, I think he just ends up just making a mistake and trying to rush the ball, and it ends up getting blocked. So it's like, it's a strange one for me that it is a howler. At the same time, it is not one where it like bounces under his foot and goes in, or he makes some like fully obvious mistake here. It's a howler, but it's a lot of little mistakes that lead to it.
Indeed it was. Graham, Arsenal have won all 8 of their Premier League games since Salt Bae became the official nutritionist in Dubai over the winter break.
That's not a good idea. that's going to lead to a lot of meat and a lot of sluggish performances, I think.
You say it's not a good idea, but it seems to have had a very good effect, Tate. That's all I'm saying. Graham, how do we feel realistically? I'm going to give you the impossible question of the title race. Arsenal going to be in this one till May, do we feel?
Yeah. I think so. I think we have enough evidence at this point. This season has been, in a weird way, a bit more rounded than last season. Last season was obviously very impressive, and Arsenal flew away at the top of the table, but it felt a little bit unsustainable in those moments. We have had those periods from Arsenal this season. In fact, they've just come out of one where they scored, what was it, like 21 goals in 4 games. But we have also had matches like this one where they have had to kind of grind it out a little bit more and shown the Klopp-style mentality monsters side to their game. And this match, look, they were largely dominant in this match, as we've covered. The Brentford goal comes from a Ramsdale mistake. Brentford also come close to scoring through Ivan Toney, who has a goal of the season attempt from the halfway line, cuts across it with the outside of his boot. And to be fair to Aaron Ramsdale, it's a very good save. So I guess he redeems himself in that moment. But nonetheless, you're heading into the final 10 minutes. Brentford are a well-drilled, well-organised and talented team. That is a test. And Arsenal, time and time again this season, have passed those tests. So yeah, I think they are stronger than last season. I can't really call the title race at this point. I mean, who can? There's 1 point between 3 teams. But to answer your question, Ryan, about do we expect them to be there until the end of the season? Yeah, I do. I think this is going to go down to the wire for them.
We're getting a 3-way, says Graham. Excellent stuff indeed. Let's go to Old Trafford, shall we, Taylor? Manchester United with a 2-0 win over Everton. Bruno and Rashford with the goals. A pair of penalties in this one. The scoreline to me, Taylor, makes it sound a lot more comfortable than it was for Manchester United.
Yes, very much so. This was one where I saw the scoreline and then I watched it later on thinking, this will be fun viewing, a comfortable 2-0 win. I'm sure everybody looked good and the ball moved and Everton looked outclassed, and it was not the case at all. Everton causing many problems for Manchester United with their press. Manchester United also causing many problems for Manchester United with their lack of precision in their passing. Everton could have and should have had several goals in this one, I would say. Not necessarily that they should have done better. They just had an obscene number of opportunities, many of them because Manchester United gave the ball away cheaply, gave the ball away trying to dribble, had errant passes, had errant clearances. And it was a strange scenario for Man United of the type of game in which they are playing simultaneously too fast and too slow, where you have individuals trying to turn and play forward with one and two touches, but then you have other individuals maybe being slow to make runs or slow on the ball. And so you'll have passes being delivered when the person they're intended for is maybe 10 to 15 yards behind where they're going, and then other times when that pass is hit behind the player. And it just felt like completely out of sync for Manchester United. For Everton, I thought it was a good performance, barring two penalties, two very obvious penalties, both of them on Garnacho. If you don't have those moments, I think that this is a draw, probably, because it did not feel to me like Manchester United were going to really have consistent success. I just end up having sympathy for Everton. The match of the day stat that I saw was 47 shots from Everton against Manchester United. This season, zero goals. So Manchester United conceding ridiculous number of shots.
Yeah.
But I guess not goals against Everton, so that's positive.
It's almost freakish that Manchester United are still winning games while conceding so many shots, because it wasn't just this match. Like the numbers from this match are stark. Another stat that I saw, Taylor, was Everton had 45 entries into the penalty box, while Man United had 15 in this game. Manchester United have conceded 20 shots or more in five of the on target, I think that is, in five of their last six matches, which is obscene. And another fact statistic that I heard a couple of weeks ago was that Sheffield United have conceded more shots than any other Premier League team in a season at this stage of the season. Do you know who is closest to Sheffield United this season? Manchester United. So in any other season, they would be 20th out of 20 teams for shots conceded. I don't know what's going on with this Manchester United team. They are so weird. They're one of the weirdest teams I've ever watched.
What do you mean by that, Graham? Because I agree, but I think I'm just trying to avoid having the same old, like, is Erik ten Hag the guy? But I agree with you that they seem to have a game plan of sorts, which is defend and then counter through ruthless passing efficiency. But when all of those passes are underhit or overhit or not to their own teammates, that ruthlessness is not really there.
Yeah, I understand why you say that, because that does seem to be the tactical approach from Ten Hag. But are they executing that well?
No.
But then at the same time, they're winning games through scoring goals in that manner. It's so weird.
Yeah.
And then the other thing is, you know, you look at the number of shots that they are conceding, and let's just say you came into that, you had never watched this Manchester United team before, and their first question was, oh, who's their defensive midfielder? Your answer is, oh, that's Casemiro. Right. Has that not made a difference? Who's next to Casemiro? Oh, this highly rated, soon-to-be England international who might go to the Euros, 17-year-old Kobbie Mainoo is a superstar. Right, but they're still conceding loads of shots. Yep. Weird team. Weird team.
But defensive midfielder Scott McTominay is our number 10. What more do you need, Graham? What more do you need? You know who's been good? Ben White. Should we talk about Arsenal some more? Should we get away from Manchester United? Maybe not. But I think we've talked about Man United plenty. They're frustrating. Yeah. Arsenal are good. Ben White good.
Yeah.
But Saka good, very good.
I enjoy that he's called Benny Blanco by the Arsenal fans. I enjoy that nickname.
That's good.
Yeah. Anyway.
Especially because he's a completely golden man, his skin complexion.
Indeed. It's ironic in that sense. Tottenham with a 4-0 win at Aston Villa this weekend in the battle for the top four. Spurs closing the gap on Aston Villa. They're in fifth, 2 points behind Villa at this point. Graham, just a case of Villa not really looking up for this one. They had a short week playing at Ajax on Thursday. John McGinn, Scotland's hero with the fabulous buttocks, seeing a red card in this one.
Not so super on the day.
Clear evidence of the Premier League's anti-Scotland agenda, if you ask me, that he sees a red card.
He would agree. His indignation at that was impressive.
I mean, he didn't really have much cause to complain,
did he? He swept the leg. He went full Cobra Kai.
Yeah.
No, he had no cause.
I don't think he has much of an argument. It's a pure Roy Keane moment where he just completely takes out the legs of the player. The bizarre thing is I've seen plenty argue that it shouldn't have been a red card, so I'm not entirely sure what era those people are living in. But yes, that didn't help.
You have to be vaguely near the ball when you make the challenge, right?
Like, no, absolutely. It just cleans him out. He'll be nice and rested for the Euros. I'm taking the silver lining from it. But yeah, this was a real statement win from Tottenham, who I thought were able to show a few different sides to their game. So in the first half, Tottenham had to stay patient. Villa were deep. That was their plan. They wanted to make it difficult for Spurs to play through them. But then in the second half, certainly when John McGinn was scandalously sent off, Tottenham really imposed themselves. I thought you could pick out a good number of Tottenham players who played very well. But I thought Pap Sarr was arguably their most important. His cross for the first goal, I think, really highlights what he offers as a player. So he receives the pass, he's on the move, he then bursts down the right side and he gets the cross in. And he's so dynamic in that midfield position. He's everywhere. He has great defensive instincts, but offers plenty on the attacking side as well. There's nobody in that Tottenham team who can do that sort of thing. So I think his absence has kind of been understated when he's been out injured, and having him back in the team is huge for Spurs. Yeah. As for Villa, quick beat on them. I thought Unai Emery got his setup wrong for this match, even before the John McGinn sending off. So they were set up in a back three, which isn't something they've done very often or at all this season. I know Unai Emery has used a back three in the past, but it hasn't been a feature of this Villa team's play this season. And I guess the idea was that it would prevent Tottenham and build up through the middle, and then Villa would be able to hit on the counter through Liam Bailey and Ollie Watkins and get in behind that way. The issue was that Villa just couldn't play out. Konsa struggled really, really badly in this regard. That was a factor in the second Spurs goal. Ollie Watkins was isolated in the attack.
It was the factor in the second goal, but yes.
Yes, it was the largest determining factor in the second goal. Watkins very isolated for a lot of the match. There wasn't, to be fair to him, there wasn't a lot he could do with the long balls coming at him. So it was just a matchup. And Unai Emery contributed to this with his setup. It was a matchup that very much favoured Spurs, and they made the most of the advantage.
I think Spurs were excellent in this one. I thought their defensive approach really paved the way. The intensity of the press, how high up they were setting their line of engagement, and then everyone just knowing their responsibilities. Once again, we see an Ange Postecoglou Spurs team be very disciplined, very well organised, and very seamless in their movements. Again, not breaking any ground to say the fullbacks move centrally, but the way Udogie and Pedro Porro took up their positions in sort of advanced half spaces, whenever there was that out ball out wide to Villa's wingbacks, it was there, but it wasn't, because both of those fullbacks for Spurs were sort of splitting the difference and would close it down. Even if it went into feet, they would close down and force that ball backwards. But it never really looked that tempting, I think. So then eventually Villa would go long. And then with Villa's front two being sort of manhandled by the two center backs for Spurs, with the fullbacks picking up the loose balls and the secondary balls, it just meant that it was suffocating for Villa, essentially. And I think that's where you see those individual mistakes as the players tried not to have long balls, not to just give the ball right back to Spurs. Those passes started to go awry. I think confidence definitely was on the wane. And then a red card from John McGinn does not help. My final note on that would be, I think there is a possibility that it would have been a yellow card if John McGinn had stopped and done the, like, oh, I didn't mean to do that, I'm sorry, and like checked on Udogie and done the sort of things to show contrition that he just walks away and then gets into it with players. I think in that moment, if you're the official, obviously, who doesn't? But I think if you're the official, you think, okay, he must have meant to do that. He is definitely getting into it with people. That's a red card.
Well, that's just his upbringing, John McGinn in Scotland. If you do that in Scotland, your team gets awarded a goal, you get made first minister, you get a cash prize. Yeah, that's what he was expecting.
You get a job at Aberdeen for a few weeks if you want it. it's a learning. Of course, we've neglected to mention that the mighty Timo Werner scored the fourth goal for Spurs. Two goals in two games now. He can't be stopped. Ballon d'Or, hand it to him.
He will be. He will be stopped. I mean, this is good for him, and he's offering something to Spurs, but yeah, he's not going to average a goal every game until the end of the season.
It's another good goal from him in terms of finding the pocket of space, adjusting his body to make sure he's open. But it's an even better run from Son Heung-min to get into the box, to carry that ball forward, and then find him on that cutback. Son, who himself scored a lovely third goal, he was pretty excellent as well in this game.
One more player that I would highlight, a player that I didn't expect to be as important to Tottenham as he has been this season, is Brennan Johnson, who is really starting to find some form. He started on the left wing here, had real intent to go forward, made a difference throughout the match. He's a good dribbler. He's effective at carrying the ball into forward areas, but also very strong on the defensive side and winning the ball back and pressing from the front. He's kind of the perfect big Ange wide player. And the numbers he's putting up now as well, 3 goals and 2 assists in his last 6 games. Yeah, he's been much more important to Spurs than I expected would be the case in his first season there.
Well, a team who could have used Brendan Johnson's services would be Nottingham Forest this weekend, a 1-0 loss at Brighton. Brighton coming off a 4-0 hammering at the Olympico against Roma on Thursday. Back to winning ways, Taylor, are Brighton.
Indeed, at the expense of Nottingham Forest and very much at the expense of Gio Reyna, who was once again not in the squad for this one. Things not going swimmingly for him in that loan spell at Nottingham Forest. He supposedly picked up a knock against Liverpool that kept him out of training ahead of the Brighton match, but not a ton of reporting on what that is. Some rumors that it's the hamstring again, but who knows? Either way, 4 appearances since making that move on deadline day in January. For a total of 39 minutes, his longest appearance was 17 minutes in a 3-2 loss to Newcastle. In the time since he's been there, they have played 8 games. So I'm going to say 39 minutes over the course of 8 games is not ideal, certainly not what he was hoping for when he made that move to Forest.
All right, Crystal Palace with a 1-1 draw against Luton this weekend. Corley Woodrow with a 96th-minute equaliser. Corley Woodrow does sound to me like someone who was part of the team who wrote the constitution originally.
I was. I thought you were going to say what one of your 90s Premier League quiz players, which Luton have a few of those, like Carlton Morris, Woodrow. Yeah, they've been transported 30 years forward from the 90s.
If not more, indeed. That point could be vital for Luton in their quest for survival. Crystal Palace have conceded 21 goals in the last 15 minutes of their Premier League matches, more than any other side. They are a relegation team in the final 15 minutes of any game, it seems. Not sure what's going on there. Bournemouth with a 2-2 draw against Sheffield United. Sheffield United had the lead twice in this one. A stoppage time equaliser from Bournemouth, meaning their points were reduced to just 1. And another 2-2 I wanted to mention was West Ham's draw with Burnley. Danny Ings against his former side with a 91st-minute equaliser there. And Datra Fofana with an absolute rocket of a goal in this game.
Is every former Chelsea forward scoring goals at the moment? If he's scoring goals now, we had Pulisic, spoiler
Lukaku
alert, we had a Pulisic winner.
Spoiler alert, Lukaku did not.
But we've got Timo Werner, Kai Havertz.
Yeah.
Leave Chelsea and you will score goals, is the moral of the story.
Oh, boy. How about someone who left Tottenham to score goals? Let's go to the Bundesliga, shall we? Bayern Munich 8, Mainz 1. Harry Kane, the first man to score 4 hat-tricks in his debut Bundesliga season. That's 30 goals, Graham, in 25 league games for Harold Kane. And an assist for Musiala in this game as well.
I don't like him being called Harold. That totally threw me.
That's what the Bayern social media account calls him, Harold Kane.
Of course they do.
Which always makes me laugh.
Of course they do.
Isn't it? I'm sure there's a World War II reason for that, because Harry... Anyway, that's a conversation for another time.
I think I would have thought it was Harrison. I really would have thought it was Harrison Kane, which also sounds like a villain from a movie. What was the first in Colley Woodrow and Harrison Kane starring in, I don't know, Chain Reaction 2. Yeah.
Also, Graham, Serge Gnabry with a filthy finish in this game as well for his goal to back heel volley. Lovely.
There were a lot of nice goals in this game, and as the scoreline suggests, this was much more like it from Bayern Munich. And before we talk about what Bayern did well here, can I just spotlight the one goal that Mainz scored in this game? Because it is an absolute laser of a strike by Nadim Amiri from about 25 yards into the top corner. It might be the best goal of the weekend. Unfortunately for them, it only counted for one goal and they got thumped 8-1. But yes, 3 of the Bayern goals belong to Harold Kane, now has 4 hat-tricks in the Bundesliga this season. I thought the biggest difference for Bayern in this game was just how good their crossing was. They weren't allowing Mainz to get into their defensive shape. It was all about setting the cross and getting it in quickly and having players attack it, which sounds so simplistic, but it was very, very effective. Players getting around the back, players making good runs. The Kane assist for the Musiala goal to make it 5-1. We had one of the goals of the season in this game. I think that was one of the assists of the season. I'm not sure if I would call it a cross, but it's a sensational early crossfield pass in behind, and it highlighted how Bayern were just more incisive in those moments to get players forward. Between this and the Lazio game, last week was much more like it for Bayern. We'll see how long it lasts.
It was. Well, they've got 9 games to catch up 10 points on by Leverkusen. Leverkusen with a 2-0 win over Wolfsburg this weekend. They're still unbeaten. Wolfsburg down to 10 men in this game. Stat for you, Graham. Bayern now have won as many matches this season as the previous season's champion, FC Bayern, as many as they won after 34 games. So, yeah, they're good.
Yeah, they are indeed another step towards the title from Leverkusen and the definitely not owned by multinational conglomerate derby, as I like to call this one. This was complete dominance from Leverkusen in a way that the 2-0 scoreline doesn't quite reflect. The red card to Moritz Jentsch, former Celtic player. I didn't really realise he was at Wolfsburg, so that was a weird flashback for me watching this game. That certainly helped Leverkusen, because Wolfsburg, up until that point, there was a little spell when they were starting to impose themselves a bit in the match at that moment. But after that, just very comfortable for Leverkusen. Grimaldo's assist for the first goal is amazing. So he loses his man in the box with a little flick and then stands up the cross for Nathan Teller to head in. And then it's a Florian Wirtz volley from a Palacios pass over the top to make it 2-0. So yeah, just ticking off the matches for Leverkusen now. I know Bayern Munich have maybe turned a corner a little bit, but 10 points in 9 games, that's going to be too much to make up.
Is this a non-50-plus-1 derby for the Bundesliga as well? These two teams, right? I think they both.
Yeah, these two teams are the ones that the Bundesliga pretends doesn't violate their entire constitution.
Which they do. All right, Werder Bremen with a 2-1 home defeat to Borussia Dortmund. A great goal from Jadon Sancho, listener, if you haven't seen it. Skins his defender on the outside and goes through and slots home. Very nice indeed. And Donny Malen with a very nice volley finish in that goal in that game for Dortmund as well. Wanted to also bring your attention to Gladbach's 3-3 draw with Cologne. The Rhine derby, this one. A very, very heated affair. Quite heated the night before when police made 205 arrests between this one. There were so many arrests, Taylor, that buses from a local transport company were needed to process the high number of people taken into custody before this.
Prison buses.
Is there bad blood between Gladbach and Köln? Is that a thing?
It's a derby. It's a Rhine derby.
I don't think
I
knew that. All right, there we go. 205. What a very specific number.
Indeed, and 6 goals as well. Lots of numbers coming out of the Rhine region this weekend. Let's take a quick break, shall we? When we come back, we'll talk about the Liga, Serie A, and of course the W Gold Cup coming shortly.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League One? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Total Soccer Show, welcome back to our weekend review. Let's go to Spain, shall we? There were wins for Barcelona, Real Madrid, and Girona. Barcelona, we'll start off with Graham, a 1-0 win over Mallorca at home.
Yeah, this was always going to be a tricky match for Barcelona, coming just a few days before that Champions League second leg against Napoli, which they definitely have more than one eye on, and also with Gavi, Pedri and De Jong all injured. So that's their entire midfield unit at the moment. So they don't really have much of a supply line into the attack besides Ilkay Gundogan, who had a penalty saved in this match. I thought Real Mallorca, they carried a threat at times. Ter Stegen had to make a number of saves. It wasn't the most enthralling of matches. I'm not really enjoying watching Barcelona, certainly in La Liga at the moment, not a huge deal to play for. And it seems like Xavi didn't enjoy watching this match either, because he was caught watching the Napoli match on his laptop during the game.
Wait, they were playing
at the same time.
Are you serious?
Yep, so Xavi was suspended from the touchline for this match, so he was watching it up in like a director's box, and the TV cameras caught him. He had a laptop placed perched in front of him, and he was watching the Napoli match live on his computer.
That feels like a mistake. That feels like the thing that you're not really going to be able to pay attention to, so you're inevitably going to have to watch it again later. I feel like that's a rookie mistake from Xavi.
Double screening is a man after my own heart. He needed a third and fourth screen, though. But yes, that is a thing that actually happened. So, not really enjoying watching Barcelona right
Graham,
now.
I'm not sure you know what double means when you add a third and a fourth screen. I'm just throwing that out there.
Double-double.
Yeah, double-double, yeah. Lamine Yamal, he is the only reason that I'm watching Barcelona in La Liga right now. His winner was a piece of magic. He is a special, special player. He hit the bar with another amazing shot in this match. He has put Barcelona on his back this year in 2024, and he is carrying them as a team. The concern is he is playing a huge amount of minutes, and as we all saw, that did not work out particularly well for Pedri. But if he can stop his knees from being ground into dust by Barcelona's non-existent load management plan, he's going to be very, very important for them over the next few years, maybe even like a decade or longer. He's that good.
Many years ago, Graham, I was at an NYCFC game at Yankee Stadium in the press box. On my laptop, I put a Premier League game on because the NYCFC one was so unentertaining. I got some very dirty looks for doing that. So I pulled a Xavi. I was a trailblazer. Let's say that.
yeah, copied you.
He did, yeah. Girona with a 2-0 win over Osasuna, and Real Madrid with a 4-0 win over Celta, Graham.
Yeah, obviously a comfortable match for Real Madrid, as the scoreline suggests. But even in this game, they did the Real Madrid sort of thing of coasting for most of it and then having a strong 20-minute spell, and that was enough. I thought Modric and Camavinga were the best players on the pitch. Camavinga's form has sort of gone under the radar a little bit, but he's been excellent for a good number of weeks now, and the ground he covered here, the goal threat he had as well. I think he had like 3 or 4 really good attempts from the edge of the box in this game. He is getting better and better and more valuable for Real Madrid. Luca Della Torre had a decent opportunity right at the end of the first half to equalise, but heads over at the back post. But the main headlines from this game, though, were Brahim Diaz, who started because Bellingham is suspended after being sent off against Valencia last week. After the match, it came out that he's decided to play for Morocco over Spain, and that has caused a bit of discussion in Spain because he's been very good recently. We've spoken about him on the show a number of times, and I think a lot of fans believe that Spain could use someone like him at the Euros, but he's never been called up by De La Fuente, and now he's going to play for Morocco. The other headline was Arda Güler, who was only on the pitch for 4 minutes, but that is all he needed to score a very nice, very well-taken goal. Rounds the goalkeeper, puts it into the back of the net. There is so much excitement about him at Real Madrid. There's been excitement from the moment he signed earlier in the season. There's been little flashes in the Copa del Rey and other competitions off the bench. Ancelotti has so far resisted the temptation to throw him in at the deep end, but we are surely going to see more of him soon, certainly next season, because he looks like an incredible talent.
Graham, one quick question for me about Camavinga. What do you feel like is his best position? I feel like we've seen him in so many different spots, but where do you feel like he is most likely to shine?
I still feel like by trade he is like a midfield anchor of sorts. But you're right. He's played in so many different positions. He was excellent at left back earlier in the season. Now at left back, when he played there, he had the freedom to push into the centre of the pitch. So he's still on the ball playing as a midfielder. But he's got good attacking instincts as well. So he's just really an excellent all-round central midfielder, and it feels like Real Madrid are going to build around him for the next few years. He's a really good player.
Over to Italy, where Inter, surprise, surprise, they won a game. 1-0 over Bologna, at Bologna, I should say. Now 16 points clear, the 12th consecutive win in all competitions for Inter. They remain, Graham, the Max Verstappen of soccer, in a reference that you will get.
I quite like Inter, and I'm not the biggest fan of Max Verstappen, so I'm just going to ignore that reference and pretend he is like Djokovic of... I don't really like Djokovic either. Do I just like players who are... people in teams who are successful, like, don't really like people who win things, as my fandom of Sterling Albion proves.
There we go. Yeah, that's a lifestyle. I subscribe to it also. Milan with a 1-0 win over Empoli. Christian Pulisic with the goal, his 8th goal of the season, putting Milan into second place. Whoop, whoop.
Yeah, it was America's weekend in Serie A with Weston McKennie better than Kevin De Bruyne, more on that later,
correct,
and Christian Pulisic winning 3 points on his own for Milan.
Here.
Now, I'm not entirely sure, I don't know if Taylor or Ryan, you've seen the goal. I'm not entirely sure how his shot actually ends up in the back of the net.
Majestic deflection? Majestically is the word you're looking for.
It's more than a deflection, Ryan. It's the Empoli, whoever the Empoli defender is, I can't remember who it is, just takes a swing at it and kind of like kicks it backwards into his own net. So, yeah, a little bit fortunate.
However, made him do that. I don't understand what's confusing about this.
Yeah,
he knew it was
freedom. It was all the freedom he felt around him, Taylor. Yeah. That's what it was.
It was the eagle tattoo gave him the power.
Mm-hmm.
We
it's
all
got
know
the
this.
Force, yeah.
Yes.
But. Yeah, the run that he makes, Pulisic, into the central area from the right to get on the end of the cross, that was good. It was a little bit deeper than he usually does, but that's been such an indicator. I've mentioned this before about Christian Pulisic. Whenever he's playing well for a team, I always think I'm looking for those runs into central area because it disappeared from his game at Chelsea, but he's so good at that movement. We're seeing it more and more from him for AC Milan, and I guess it made the difference here, even if the defending from Empoli wasn't great.
And another game week, another opportunity for Juventus to drop points, as you thought they did against Atalanta, had a 2-1 lead, finished 2-2. Graham, tell us how Weston McKennie is better than Kevin De Bruyne.
Yes, please.
Go.
And say it
okay,
slowly.
So not better than Kevin De Bruyne, but close to Kevin De Bruyne. So only Kevin De Bruyne has recorded more assists in all competitions in Europe's top five leagues in 2024 than Weston McKennie. So I guess we might as well just give him the Ballon d'Or now. He was very good in this game. Not a great result for Juve, who are sliding down the Serie A table rather quickly, down to third now. And it kind of feels like their season is fizzling out. But yeah, Weston McKennie is red hot at the moment. Two assists in this match for him. The first one is a lovely little pass-through for Cambiasso after a good exchange with Chiesa on transition. And then the second one is a sort of Berbatov-esque chest down for Milik to finish inside the box. It's just there's nothing more to it really, Taylor. There's a cross into the box, he chests it down, but it reminded me of something that Dimitar Berbatov would do because he's very much, he knows exactly in his mind what he's trying to do in that moment. He's setting up Milik for the shot and he puts it in the back of the net. So maybe not better than Kevin De Bruyne, but up there with Kevin De Bruyne if you look at one very small category of statistics only for the last 2 months.
Wow. So Weston McKennie and Timo Werner head-to-head for the Ballon d'Or this coming year. Looking
what a year it's going to be.
What a year! Taylor, Fiorentina with a 2-2 draw against Roma. Dele De Rossi's team rarely dropping points. I think it's only the Inter game they've dropped points in besides this one.
Yeah, so I wanted to see how different they look under Daniele De Rossi, if there has been a turnaround. They looked very similar to what they looked like under Jose Mourinho. They looked very slow, very sluggish in this game. I think he got his approach wrong. They came out in a back three, and that was not working particularly well for them in a 3-4-2-1. Fiorentina pressed them, really caught them out a number of times, and I think Roma just didn't have the familiarity with playing the way they wanted to play in this game. And so Fiorentina looked very, very good for large stretches of the first half, probably could have been up by more. And then Roma able to get a good header from Awa, but I felt like this was going to be Fiorentina getting the win at the end, especially once they go up 2-1. Belotti in there, getting assists, battling for everything, holding it up. I thought he was immense and just very solid for Fiorentina. He made them look even better than they did. And then Roma get the equalizer very, very late. It's probably the last kick of the ball. It's Evan Ndicka heads down to Llorente, who smashes home a volley. And so it's
such
a draw.
Good finish.
It was so good. It was really, it's just a really pretty one because of the angle. You can follow it the whole way in and the way it like smashes in the back of the net and drops down dead. It was just a great finish and a good end of the game. But it did feel sort of like though De Rossi makes smart changes, he makes a structural change in I think like the 33rd minute and changes the personnel then as well. I think they did not start particularly strong. They did not look particularly dominant. They get back into it. They get the draw. So I guess overall a positive result. But it was not a night and day difference from the Roma of a couple months ago, put it that way.
Indeed. One more game to draw your attention to, listener, from Italy. Ryan's goal of the weekend came from Monza's 3-2 win at Genoa. Danny Motta with a bicycle kick, which looks, this one looks like it's going to win some kind of award. I feel like it's a very, very good bicycle kick indeed. Do look it up. Graham, have you just watched it? I just sent you the link.
I watched it over the weekend. I thought you were going to highlight Lecce sacking their manager after headbutting an opposition striker, which is a thing that happened on Sunday.
That did also happen, yes. They had to let their coach go, unfortunately, after that one. Lots of great stuff happening in Italy. By the way, back to that Monza game, the winner coming from Daniel Maldini, who's on loan for Milan, where his father and his grandfather did quite good things. Daniel Maldini. There we go. Let's go to Joe Lowry's MLS Corner. Joe's been very quiet on this episode. Joe, you're up. Joe, let's go.
Hi, I'm Joe Lowry.
There he is. In lieu of Joseph Lowry, Graham, and able to touch on a few score lines. The big one, surely, is that America's team, who aren't called Wrexham, Inter Miami, having a defeat here without Leo Messi on Sunday evening.
Yeah, I watched this one live on Sunday evening. An entertaining match. I think we saw the three things that could hinder Inter Miami this season. The first one is depth. So no Leo Messi in the squad for this one. Busquets and Suarez were on the bench, and that was with one eye on the CONCACAF Champions Cup second leg against Nashville this week. And Inter Miami struggled without them. Jordi Alba took it upon himself to be their primary playmaker, certainly in the second half when they were chasing the game. He scored a lovely goal from outside the box, by the way. But it wasn't until Busquets and Suarez came on that they had some real attacking purpose. The other things were set pieces, which was a problem for Inter Miami defending them last season. Two Montreal goals came from set pieces. And they scored their third by getting in behind that problematic high defensive line by Inter Miami. So it was a full bingo card for anyone looking to expose them this season. They have a lot of talent, but also some pretty big weaknesses.
Indeed. How about, Graham, we go to Canada for Toronto's 1-0 win over Charlotte FC. Lorenzo Insigne making the difference in this one.
Yeah, I watched this match for about 79 minutes and not much happened. And then I tweeted at that point that I'd chosen to watch TFC versus Charlotte FC and was regretting that decision and was turning over to the other match, which seemed more entertaining. As soon as I turned over to the other match, Lorenzo Insigne pops one in the top corner from 25 yards, a goal of the season contender, I'm sure it will be. He's been really good this season, Lorenzo Insigne. Also scored a nice goal against the Revs last week. And then I know Joe highlighted this on his social feed as well. The way that Insigne celebrates with John Herdman and his flesh-coloured AirPod, I thought that really hinted at the buy-in that Herdman has got from this squad. It clearly Insigne likes Herdman a lot more than he liked Bob Bradley. I know that's a low bar. But TFC are unbeaten through their first three games of the season. And I don't think anyone predicted that. There are also some unexpected storylines with the Portland Timbers winning away at NYCFC on Saturday. Evander scoring a late stunner for them. NYCFC, they've lost all three of their opening MLS fixtures now, while Portland are unbeaten, excuse me. So that's definitely what we all expected in our preseason predictions. Minnesota United being good while they are waiting for their new manager, Eric Ramsey, to arrive. And while they're also without their best player in Emmanuel Reynoso, that's another thing that we all expected. Of course, they went to Orlando and beat them 3-2, a brace for Timo Pukki in that game. Orlando, not started the season well. They better be better by the time I go to one of their games next month, because I want to see an entertaining match. Then at Atlanta, this is maybe not so unexpected because we all thought Atlanta were going to be strong this season. We got a real show of strength from them, who thumped New England 4-1, a goal from the spot for Thiago Almada, and a hat-trick for Georgios Giakoumakis. The finish for his second goal is incredible. Go check it out if you haven't seen it. He takes it down at the back post and then thumps it back across goal into the top corner. He is the best pure number 9 in MLS, in my opinion, and he was my non-Messi pick for MVP before the start of the season. So I'm feeling a little bit better about that now that he's got three goals to his name.
Thank you for bringing up John Herdman's flesh-coloured AirPod. That bothered me quite a lot watching that, Graham. He's actually gone
it bothers
to store.
Me every time. Yeah, it's so weird.
He's gone somewhere and asked for that to be made. It's offensive. But also, I was thinking Xavi needs one of those, so then he can listen to the Napoli game and no one will notice because it's camouflaged. Yeah. You know? Yeah.
Do the thing that I used to do in school, which is feed the wire up your sleeve and then lean on your hand like that. Yep, I think we all did that.
Yeah, I remember there was a World Cup once where I was in like a science class and there was a few of us leaning on our hand with AirPods or, you know,
everyone with very heavy heads.
And then someone would go, Shearer, when a goal had gone in. It was magical time indeed. USL kicked off this weekend too. Just like to highlight one amusing moment, Sacramento Republic with a 2-2 draw against Orange County SC, the mighty Orange County SC, a 96th minute equaliser from OCSC from their goalkeeper, Colin Shuttler. Go check that one out. That's a pretty cool moment. And let's, Taylor, go to the W Gold Cup lifted high.
Champions,
woo, baby. USWT winning with a 1-0 win over Brazil in Santiago. Lindsay Horan with the goal.
Yep, a good goal at that, a nice header, an even better ball from Emily Fox to the back post. Alex Morgan does some good work to sort of block off Antonia, the Brazilian defender. I don't know what Leal, the right wing back, was doing. She just sort of lets Lindsay Horan go in front of her. I think she's so focused on the battle between Morgan and Antonia that maybe she forgets that she should also be defending, but then it's a good header. It's well taken. It's back across goal into the far side netting. And it felt like from that point on, and even leading up to that, the U.S. was just sort of like not necessarily dominant, but just sort of controlling in an unimpressive way. Like Brazil had opportunities. They have shots. The post-game conversation was much about how Brazil had the better opportunities and Brazil were sort of threatening the United States. If you watch those opportunities, a lot of them are from distance or from outside the box, or they're sort of half chances that are contested. And even the last chance they have is sort of cleared away by Casey Kruger. No Brazilian there to really make any sort of contact or make a big threat. So it felt like the United States, I wouldn't say dominant, I wouldn't say controlled. They had fewer possession, they had fewer shots, they had significantly more fouls. But I also don't feel like Brazil were sort of putting them under and really pressuring them, and the United States held on. It sort of felt like they got a 1-0 lead and then just sort of ground their way to being eventual champions. So credit to them for getting the results, for getting the trophy, and for maybe removing some of the lingering sadness from the last World Cup. I'm not sure how much the Gold Cup is going to do that, but maybe a little bit.
Yeah, I think it might have done a little bit, Taylor. I only caught the highlights of this match, so I can't speak too much to the intricate tactical stuff that was happening. But looking at the broad picture, this is clearly a very positive thing ahead of the Olympics and Emma Hayes arriving. The USWNT, they look broken after the World Cup. And we all know about this team needing a new identity and a new clearer vision of what that team should be and the way that they should play. We've all had that discussion. I'm not sure we got that at this tournament or if we were ever going to get that. I think that will come when Hayes fully takes over in the summer. And maybe not even then. It might take a while for her to impose herself. But the US also seemed to be broken mentally after the World Cup. And that's where I think this tournament probably has helped to repair some things, not everything, certainly. But you look at the run in this tournament in the knockout rounds, Colombia, Mexico in that swimming pool in San Diego, and then Brazil. That is a challenging run. And while I wouldn't say the US truly flexed their muscle in any of those games, they kind of ground it out along the way. To get through that and win with a trophy and have that celebration, I think that has to be cathartic on some sort of level.
Yeah, incredible stuff from USWNT. Lest we forget, of one of 100% of all W Gold Cups held historically now. So congratulations.
We look forward to the next one.
Yeah, incredible record. The other business section, Graham, I've just got a note on PSG, had a duh-duh draw with Rennes. Kylian Mbappe even, starting on the bench, came on in the 73rd minute, but not enough to make the difference in this one. A third league draw in a row, but 10 points clear. Is the PSG thing just like punish him in the league, but then when you need it in the Champions League, like, let him cook, basically?
Yeah, make him angry and then unleash him on Real Sociedad is pretty much the tactic at this point, yep.
Wonderful stuff. All right, let's wrap up this weekend review, shall we? Taylor Rockwell, it's been a pleasure chatting with you, my good man.
The pleasure was mine, my good man.
Likewise with you, Graham Ruthven. Thank you very much, sir.
The pleasure was not mine, really, Ryan Bailey, but thanks anyway.
And thank you very much to Joe Lowry. Good
stuff.
Thanks, Ryan. Listener, there he is. Listener, thank you very much for joining us on the feed. We'll be back very shortly, but for now, bye!